So there's this refrain towards the end of the book of Judges, this phrase that's sort of repeated over and over again. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And the bulk of the book of Judges shows this sort of cycle where the people would face a big crisis, and they would cry out to God. God would pick out one of the people and empower them to deal with the crisis. And that person, that judge, would deal with it, and things would go back to how they had been before. This was sort of the same cycle that we see in Exodus and Numbers and Leviticus, Deuteronomy. It's crisis, the people cry out, God hears them, God picks someone and empowers them to deal with it. But the threats for most of the book of Judges were external threats. Then, starting in about chapter 17, the focus shifts to a series of internal threats. The people of Israel fighting each other. And it all starts with 17:6. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and all the people did what was right in their own eyes. And what we see in those final four chapters is this increasingly horrific series of stories, each separated by the phrase, there was no king in Israel. And at the very end of the book, following a story where one of the tribes of Israel was almost completely wiped out, a situation they decided to resolve, incidentally, by kidnapping women from another tribe, and the book ends by reiterating that at that time there was no king in Israel, and all the people did what was right in their own eyes. And in those last four chapters, no one really seemed to be interested in doing what God wanted. They were just doing what looked good to them, what was right in their own eyes. So maybe it's not that surprising that the people looked around. They saw these other nations, nations that didn't have the same infighting that Israel had. And they asked themselves, why are they so stable while we nearly wiped each other out? And that's easy, they thought. Those guys have a king. They have one authority that controls everything, the military, the taxation, who appoints leaders, settles disputes. When something happens in Israel, we have to rely on God. We have to wait for him to pick a leader who has to go around and wrangle together 12 separate tribes. And that seemed terribly inefficient, I guess. And so the people went to the current judge, Samuel, and they said, hey, look, we want a king too. And it can't be your kids because your kids suck. That's 1 Samuel 8:5, by the way. But you are the one with a direct line to God, so we want you to choose our king for us. And Samuel was furious. He didn't want to do it. He knew that God was supposed to be king of Israel. He knew that setting a human being on God's throne was nothing short of idolatry. But God tells Samuel to give Israel their human king. And God tells the people point blank that they're rejecting him by doing so. He even ties it directly back to the story of the golden calf, where the people had chased after other gods on their way out of Egypt. He tells the people that this king's going to take their sons and their daughters for his armies and for his servants, He'll take a tenth of their flocks, the first fruits of their fields and their vineyards, all for his table and his servants. And when the people cry out to God, he will not deliver them if they do this. And the language that he uses here is really important, actually, because a tenth of their harvest and the first fruits of their field, these were all things that were supposed to belong to God. They were being warned that should they pursue this path, the king would demand for himself the honor and loyalty that properly belonged to God alone. And then when the people cry out to God, which, incidentally, that's the same word that's used for the people crying out for deliverance from foreign oppressors when armies would march into Israel and attack the people. It's the same word that's used for how they are going to cry out against the king. And God warns them that he won't raise up a judge to save them. They'll be on their own. But the people wanted their king, their human king, one they could see and touch and hear. They wanted what everyone else had. And they were willing to trade the lordship of God to do it. And when you look at the overarching narrative of Israel in the Old Testament, this was the deciding moment. This was the choice that eventually led to the splitting of the northern and southern kingdoms. And that a few generations beyond that would eventually lead them into exile in Babylon. This decision was the turning point. And that phrase that I mentioned, that the people all did what was right in their own eyes, that we find in those final few chapters of Judges, is replaced by a different refrain that echoes all the way through Kings and Chronicles. The king was this many years old when he began to reign, he reigned for that many years, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Power was no longer based on actions or devotion, but on birth. The whole nation would prosper or perish based on the quality of whoever happened to be seated on that throne. And none of them, not even the best of them, not David himself, had the character needed to fully fill that role. Because that place belonged to God alone. And it took 1,000 years for God to restore that broken relationship. It took God emptying himself, humbling himself, taking on flesh and frailty and suffering, being born into the line of David. That's what it took before God in the person of Jesus Christ could finally, once more, be called King of Israel. I mean, in terms of far-reaching consequences, this was the worst misstep outside of those first few chapters of Genesis. So, what do we do with this? What can we learn from this? I think at the very least, we need to take away a warning. Not necessarily about kings. That was more their hang-up than ours. I don't think anyone here would really want to put a king in charge, Mark being the possible exception. Yeah. The warning we need to take away is about emulating the world around us. Because although demanding a king was a whopper of a mistake, it was not the first or the last time that the people of God would fall into this same type of error. I mean, just think back 2 weeks to the story that Terry dealt with Abraham wanting to sacrifice his son Isaac. I mean, Abraham looked around at the people, the nations around him, and he saw that the sacrifice of a firstborn son was considered the highest offering that you could make to a god. And it took God leading him all the way through that process, stopping him at the last possible moment to disabuse him of that notion. Or when Israel was in the desert, waiting for Moses to come down from the mountain, they saw the people around them worshiping statues and images, and they thought, that seems to work for them. Hey, Aaron, make us some gods. And then in Deuteronomy 12:31, before the people enter the promised land, Moses warns the people not to model their worship after what they see the other nations doing. But in spite of that early warning, it was still enough of a problem that Jeremiah, right before the exile, had to reiterate that same warning. And then when Israel came to the promised land, even though God had promised to drive out the people living there with droughts and locusts and generally making the land so intolerable that the inhabitants would just move, they thought, hey, every other nation, they make war, they conquer their lands. Let's do that instead. And then here in 1 Samuel, all these other nations have kings. Why not us? And lest we think that this was all the ancient Israelites, let's take a quick look at what happened around the year 312. That's when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire. And all of a sudden, Christian theologians were doing mental backflips, trying to defend cultural and political institutions that the previous generations of Christians had railed against. Cornerstones of Christ's teaching, like love for your enemies and servant leadership, went out the window in a single generation. God and culture came face to face, and the people molded their image of God to fit the world. And that, my friends, is idolatry. And we still face that dilemma. I mean, churches today might not ask God to give them a king, but I've seen churches asking God, for all intents and purposes, for a CEO. I've seen churches asking their people to put their trust in some political institution. And I've seen churches advocating for the use of force, because that's what the rest of the world does. But we are not the rest of the world. And we're not supposed to be. We're supposed to be salt and light, a city on a hill. We're supposed to be the example the rest of the world looks to. An example of all the ways the world needs to change. And when we look to the rest of the world as our guiding light, we're moving in exactly the wrong direction. Even when we look at the seemingly successful examples, when we find ourselves saying, hey, it works for them, why not us? The second we start thinking in those terms, we've lost sight of our true goal. Because the reality is, if we try to look like the rest of the world, we're going to succeed. It is frighteningly easy to go with the flow, to let our culture and our surroundings dictate who we are. But I've long believed that one of the most beneficial traits of the Mennonite tradition is that they've always assumed they're going to look and act very differently from the world around them. And say what you will about the exact ways that's expressed itself, that's a good instinct. A very good instinct to have. We need to cultivate a healthy skepticism of our culture, of any culture. We need to constantly reevaluate the assumptions that we bring to the table. And when we find ourselves looking or thinking like the rest of the world, that should make us fundamentally uncomfortable. But it's hard. It's really hard. Because culture isn't something you can get away from. And we're social creatures. We're always in relationship. People always have an influence on us. And we're surrounded by structures and organizations that seem to work pretty well. Like the monarchies that surrounded Israel, a lot of these groups are successful under some definition of success. But we have to accept that our success will look inherently different from the world around us. After all, we look at a man nailed to a cross and we think victory. Or, I mean, we should, right? So how do we keep that vision, that mindset, in the midst of our culture? Living in a world that puts forward such a different narrative from the one we know to be true. And when that alternative story presents itself, are we even going to recognize what's happening? Will we see it for the lie it is? Honestly, probably not. Not at first. More likely is that we, like Abraham, like the people of Israel, like the citizens of Rome, we too will need a wake-up call from God. And in that way, I really think that the story of Israel asking for a king is a good counterpoint for what we found in the story of Abraham offering up Isaac. Because Abraham believed God, he stayed his hand, he accepted a drastic shift in the way that he viewed God, of who God is, who God was. But Israel shut their ears to God. They insisted on getting a king. They rejected the shift in their mindset. And they did what was right in their own eyes. What will we do? I want us to spend a few minutes reflecting on the ways that we have been shaped by our culture and what ways God might be calling us to stand apart from the world.